Greetings to each one of you this morning in the name of Jesus. It's been a privilege to be here this morning and worship with you so far and enjoying it. I don't know what you would choose to preach about this morning if it was your turn to preach after a week like we've just had. I told my wife, with all the good preaching we heard, we probably could just skip the message this morning and be all right. But I decided to use a message that I preached at Smithdale here a number of weeks ago. The Lord graciously provided an inspiration for a message in a rather unlikely spot. I wasn't really looking for an inspiration for a message right at the time, but it was on a billboard right beside the interstate. It's not the first message inspiration that came from a billboard, by the way, but this one caught my eye. It was on Interstate 20 east of Jackson. And some of you may have seen this, though you probably don't travel that road a lot. I was driving along, and there's a big billboard there that all it says is, "See real tractors here." And it has an arrow that points down. And you can kind of see, it's not far off the interstate, you can see a big John Deere dealer there. And that's all the sign says. It just says, "See real tractors here." You can see real tractors. Why would you put a sign like that out along I-20? I don't know if you know what it costs to advertise on a billboard along Interstate 20, but it's a lot of money. And they thought it was worth putting up a sign that says, you can see real tractors right here. Why? Why the sign? Well, probably not that many years ago. I didn't stop to think how many, but 20 years ago, a sign like that wouldn't have made near as much sense as it makes today, right? Because the way people shop, not just for tractors, but for all kinds of things, has changed a lot. When you're looking for something, rarely do we go to the store to find what's available for certain tasks anymore. Just bought another house to fix up, and there's some tile that's chipped, and I didn't go to Lowe's to see what you can pick off the shelf. I got out my phone and I looked what kind of ceramic tile repair kits are out there and how they work. Okay, that's how things have changed over the years. And whoever got the idea to put that sign out along the interstate understood that, but they understood something else. They understood that when you put your hands on the real thing, it's different than just looking at pictures and descriptions of things. And this happens when you go to trade shows and all, for using the analogy of tractors, because that's what this sign was advertising. When you go to a trade show about farming, there's a difference when you really put your hands on a tractor, and especially if you can run it. Even if it's not colored with your favorite color of paint, you gain a better appreciation for it when you see a new tractor and you see how it works, and this would be kind of nice. A lot more than if you had just seen it in a magazine or on a billboard or online, right? Yeah. So get your hands on it. You can actually see real tractors. Stop your online shopping. Stop here and see real tractors. And of course, the idea of that is they want to send you home with one, right? They're looking out for your good. They want you one with green paint instead of red paint or whatever. But they want to sell more. Seeing something in real life gives you a better appreciation for it. I like when customers come into the showroom, into the office to buy a garage door, rather than going to their house and meeting them. Usually I get to their house to measure up. But I like when they come onto our turf, because there we have actual working doors. You can hear what it actually sounds like when you run a door, and when it has the quiet rollers versus the standard, and you can see the difference. I love when customers come in and they tap on a non-insulated door versus a steel back insulated door. I can talk all day long about the benefits of it and show it to them in a brochure and even show them the hand samples, but when you see it in real life, the upsell is much, much, much easier, right? Because they gain a better appreciation for it when they see it in real life. You can understand that. Those are simple concepts. I don't know where your mind went, what you think we're going to talk about this morning, but my mind went on a journey when I saw that, and thinking about why that sign was there and why that simple message was all the sign said. Would it be fair? Could we do it to put a big sign out here. There's not near as much traffic as there is along I-20, right? But put a sign out here in front of Darvin Church that points in here and says, "See real Christians here." Would we be safe in doing that? Now, I don't want you to put a sign like that. You know that. That would seem arrogant. In fact, it would actually do away with a lot of the message this morning. It wouldn't be right to do that, probably, because it would be seeming to make a statement about all the other churches around, right? But would it be safe to do that? Would people gain a greater understanding and appreciation for Christians if they observed us closely or not? See the real thing instead of just a portrayal of it. Would that be a fair assumption to make or not? We're often asked how our churches are different. I assume you're asked very often. It happened to me maybe 2 weeks ago now, it doesn't matter. Sitting in the detention center, the ICE detention center, waiting to be admitted. They let you through first part of it, and then you sit with all the other people that are waiting for visitation, and conversations get struck up. And there was a pastor coming in to visit someone in the detention center, and somehow he picked up that I was also a church leader, and he asked what church, and I said a Mennonite church, and he said he had some questions. And his way of asking was interesting. He said, "What makes a good Mennonite?" Well, that's you're never quite sure where to start. Maybe you have all the answers where to start. I don't. But the conclusion of all that was whether you went to the congregation he was a part of or whether you went to a Mennonite church. The real answer to that is, if we name the name of Christ, what makes a good Mennonite is a good follower of Jesus Christ, right? It needs to be that way. If we name the name of Christians, then it needs to be about being a good follower of Jesus Christ and exemplifying what a real Christian is to the world. Our culture probably does not need more creed, more specifics about God and the way he works written out for them. The general society probably doesn't need more of that, though that is very, very, very important that we understand the basics of the Christian life and we understand who God is and we understand the Trinity and we understand the doctrines of the Bible. We need to understand that to come out right, but probably the world isn't going to read that so closely anymore anyway to see why Mennonites are different. But what the world desperately needs, what our culture desperately needs, is to see real Christians and see people taking that important doctrine and putting it into everyday life for them, and they will take notice of that. This morning I would like to bring this down now to just one piece of the Christian life that the Bible invites us to demonstrate Christ to the world. There are lots of other specifics we could talk about. Let's go to Philippians chapter 2, and we'll read verses. Let's take the time to read verses 1 through 15. We won't be turning to a lot of scriptures this morning. So let's take the time to read these 15 verses. Paul, in the first chapter of Philippians, he was talking about his struggle. He didn't even know whether he would choose life or death. Death would be so much better. He could go to be with Christ, but life is more needful to you. And he was talking about ministering to others. And he gets down to the last of that thought in chapter 1. And he's talking about them being willing to suffer. And having seen the same conflict which he saw in me, and I believe that was that conflict of not knowing, I don't know which to choose, however, that and that ye hear to be in me. Then he starts in chapter 2, and I went back to just lay the foundation, because he starts with these words, "If there be therefore," because of this, with this background being laid, "if there be therefore any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any bowels and mercies, fulfill ye my joy that ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others." Might sound kind of out of context, but I believe it would not be doing any harm to the translation to read it. Look not every man out for his own good, but every man also for the good of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And here's the verse that we pull out, imitating Christ. Not only imitating Christ, but become what he is. Who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself, and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Wherefore God also hath highly exalted him, and given him a name which is above every name, that the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of things in heaven, and of things in earth, and of things under the earth. And that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Wherefore, my beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is of God which worketh in you both to will and to do his good pleasure. Do all things without murmurings and disputings, that ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God, without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world. Demonstrate Christ to the world, right? We're going to stop reading there. See real Christians. See real people who possess the mind of Christ. If you want a title for this morning's message, the official title that I would like to appear is Exemplifying Christ in Humility. Exemplifying Christ in Humility. But the title I want you to keep in mind as we go along is See Real Humble Christians Here. Is that a fair? Could we proclaim that? Possessing the mind of Christ. Or we could talk about, we said see real humble Christians. We could say real meek Christians or real lowly Christians. I'd like to talk just a little bit about why we should practice humility. Why be humble is the first point that I have. The second is how to be humble. What does it really mean? And then finish up by talking very, very briefly about the results of being humble. Well, why is humility important? Why be humble? The first part, and this is just a very brief, we won't spend long here either. We've been talking about this so far in developing this subject. The motivation for humility is Christ, right? If we name the name of Christ, then it only... We need to exemplify humility in the way Christ exemplified it. That's what verse 5 of Philippians 2 is saying. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. And then it goes on to enumerate what that means. He made of himself no reputation. He took upon him the form of a servant. He was made in the likeness of men, and he became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And that's what we're going to use in the next part. So we'll just leave that for now. And all through the Gospels, even though he was king, and even though he had all authority, how he expressed humility. In reality, this morning, it's not even possible for us as human beings to demonstrate humility to the extent that Jesus demonstrated humility or practiced humility or exemplified humility. Let me use that word, because we don't have as far to humble ourselves. We can't humble ourselves as far as Christ did. And yet, in many ways, well, I don't even know how to express this thought exactly. We fall so short of it, even though we don't have as far to go. And that's our next point. So to name the name of Christ, if we're here calling ourselves Christians, which I certainly hope that all of us want to be Christians, we call ourselves Christians, then it behooves us to be like Christ in humility. That's what this chapter is saying. And also because Jesus invited us, let me just read to you one verse from Matthew 11. You don't have to turn there. I'll just read you one verse. Lifting it right out of the context which Jesus spoke it in, but not changing the application at all. And we'll go back and get the context in conclusion of the message probably. But Jesus said, well, except that I'm in Luke. I knew it wasn't at the right spot. It was in the left column instead of the right column. I know where the verse is supposed to be, right here. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. And that's part of the results of humility. But Jesus also invited us, not only exemplified it for us, but he also invited us to come and learn from him and to be meek and lowly, and we could say humble. There may be other motivations, and I know that's a very basic, a very, very, very basic two reasons for being humble, but it's the basis. It's important for us to understand that. Now, how is it expressed? Or how is practical everyday possessing the mind of Christ expressed in being lowly and being meek? How does that happen? You that have been from Darwin here for years may remember this story. I remember plainly my dad sharing this story in a message here. But a lot of you weren't here, and I think it bears repeating, and some of you may have forgotten it. It made an impact on my life, though. There was a man that recognized he had a problem with pride in some of the areas of his life, and he wanted to overcome that. And he was a farmer, and he decided that in the afternoon, when he was out working the fields, it didn't take much mental concentration, what he was doing. He was disking, and so he decided that he would spend all afternoon in prayer and in communion with God. He needed that. He wanted to be humble. And so he did that. He did well. All afternoon while he was driving his tractor, he prayed and listened to God and communed with God. And on the way back in through, in the evening when he was coming in, he got to thinking and he said, you know, that was a really good thing I did today. I wonder how many other people were willing to do that. And that's a little how it is. It catches you sometimes. And so I tell you that story to tell you this. It's probably very, very hard or maybe even impossible for us to recognize humility in our lives. What we have to look at is for the opposites. Okay, what is there in my life that is arrogant? What is there in my life that is expressing something that Jesus doesn't want to express, that Jesus did not express in his life, and root those things out? Think of humility as being the state of having pride, arrogance, and selfishness rooted out of life. And yes, we don't often think of selfishness, or I don't often think of selfishness as the opposite of pride, but it is. Remember the verses we read in Philippians 2, let nothing be done through strife and vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves, not looking for your own good, but look out for everyone else's. And think about that sometime when you have a minute, how selfishness really is the opposite of humility. I think I might have said earlier the opposite of pride. I'm sorry, but unselfishness being the opposite of pride, one of the opposites. All right, Philippians 2, the verses we read, gives four distinct areas on how Jesus expressed meekness and humility. And let's just use them for this part on how to be humble. How is real humility, how is real meekness expressed? Well, the first one is that he made himself of no reputation. He thought it was not robbery to be equal with God, or it wasn't robbery to be equal with God, but he made himself of no reputation. How are we doing in the area of making ourselves of no reputation? According to Strong's, that would mean that he made himself empty or void. He left his whole God form. Now, I'm not trying to, there's a sense in which he was all God, right? And yet, as people related to Jesus, they related to a human, right? From the humans that related to him. That's what I'm trying to say. He didn't come as some superhuman man. He came, even though he was all God, he limited himself to made of himself no reputation. And then, well, we go on even further, he made himself even lower than that, but he didn't, even as a man, he didn't carry much reputation, right? Are we willing to lose the element of personal identity that we perceive we have in our communities, in our churches, in our businesses, etc., etc.? Someone help me a while ago. I believe it was in a sermon I was listening to. I don't even remember where it came from, but someone taught me that we need to understand the difference between our reputation and our witness. And let me give you a little story of a personal experience that will hopefully help you to grasp what I'm trying to convey here. Just this week it came to me. A business acquaintance of mine, and please, I'm preaching about humility here. I want to say this humbly. I don't want you to think that I'm trying to raise myself up by saying this, because they could have said the same about you. I know they would have, probably. But a business acquaintance of mine that is, I would perceive to be definitely far further advanced in business than what I am, in standing, wins awards and so on. Anyway, they mentioned to me, they said, yes, I was just talking to another bit of business acquaintance of mine who knew you also. We were just talking about you, how nice it is to do business with you. And they went on and laid some more compliments out. Okay. Now, I know they would have said the same thing about you. There's something that happens when you hear things like that, that instantly you don't want to do anything that will ruin that reputation, right? You want those people to think well of you. There's something that feels good about you. Jesus made himself of no reputation. You understand the difference between a reputation and a witness? When it comes down to Bible principles, when it comes that we differ on Bible principles, our witness has to come first, that we stand true and people see that we're being true to Jesus Christ, even if we lose that reputation that we have. And they say, he made some foolish decisions there. He's going to lose a lot of money, right? So that's the one side of it. When we feel like people do think well of us, there's a real pressure on us. And I think it's probably especially so in business, but it can be in your neighborhoods. And it happens in church too, where we think that we carry some reputation. But then there's a flip side of that. When we hear what people said about us in a negative way, and it comes back to our ears, or people actually put other people into positions that we could have done much, much better at, right? You know, I'm speaking a little facetiously here, right? But we have those feelings. And when we don't get the reputation that we think that we should have, that hurts. And we can tend to, well, you know the tendencies of that. I don't need to reveal myself here any further. So how well am I doing when people do flatter might be the right word, show appreciation, lift us up. How well do I do with that? And how well do I do when I'm called to help people who I perceive are better off than what I am? Where does that enter in here? I believe that has a lot to do with how we perceive our reputation. Sometimes we take off of work to help someone, and in the back of our minds, we can be fighting this battle that actually I need help more than he does, right? I'm busier yet than what he is. You women take baby meals sometimes till somebody has their first baby, and you have 6 children that are all calling for your attention, right? I wonder who really has more time to be making supper. I don't know if you face those battles or not, but somewhere you face those battles, I'm sure. You know, you make yourself of no reputation and esteem other people better than yourselves and just serve them. Is the world seeing real Christians here in the Darwin community, or do they just see a portrayal or like an online version of a tractor? You follow the analogy? Do they see someone trying to portray what Christ is like, or do they see someone living what Christ is like when it comes to the area of no reputation? I'm sorry. Yes, of no reputation. And I just jumped right into being a servant. I actually got way ahead in my notes, but that's okay. That's where we were going next. In the area of being a servant, that's where I meant to bring in. These are so close together that I got ahead of myself. That's where I meant to bring in about serving other people's needs. But how about being a servant? Let's talk just a little bit about that. I had a few more thoughts on that. When we think of helping others, when we think of being a servant, we think about being willing to help others. But the context that Jesus used a servant, the word servant in, was probably lower than what we typically think of the word servant, perhaps a little closer to the word we think of slave. Someone who serves, a servant often gets paid for what he does and gets some form of recognition. But what really hurts is when we serve and we don't get any recognition for it. And this is where I meant to bring in about being willing to serve others even when we perceive that they are better off than what we are. even when they could better take care of their needs than what we could help them. So, in the area of making ourselves of no reputation, esteeming others more worthy of help, more worthy of receiving God's grace, I believe that's part of that, esteeming others better than ourselves. In the area of no reputation, in the area of being a servant, I simply ask again, if the community sees some fake portrayal of Christ, or whether they see Christ lived out, someone who really possesses the mind of Christ. Well, the third area was that Jesus made himself in the likeness of man. Well, at least we have this one conquered, right? All of us, none of us think that we're some kind of God. No, we don't. But he made himself in the likeness of man. Why did he make himself in the likeness of man? Well, because man is who? Humans, right? You understand that. He made himself in the likeness of man because man is who he was ministering to. He took on the form of a human body because he was ministering to humans and redeeming humans to Jesus Christ. And so he was willing to take upon him. This gets deep, of course, because it took a perfect sacrifice and no human could do it. And that's a whole sermon in itself. But he was willing to identify not only with humans. I don't know that we can even grasp how that was, but even the lowliest of humans. The beggars, the blind, the leprous. In Jesus' day, I want to simply remind you, weren't any nicer looking, acting, smelling than the beggars that you see on the street today. I can't imagine that they were. And yet Jesus took time to stop and minister to their needs. And I want to remind you that the same way the people that God brings into your life and the people that God takes my life through ways I don't understand and brings me in contact with people, the ones he wants to help very, very, let me rephrase that, I'm sorry, the way he wants us to help. The ones he wants us to help, the ones he wants us to minister to, very, very rarely does Jesus bring those into our lives in real neat little packages that we enjoy ministering to. They come as needy people that we would just as soon ignore and shut ourselves up in our own little world. But what do you think happens in the heart of God when needy humans that Jesus came to help look at others as below their dignity to help? How must that make him feel? And I understand that. Wait, let me hold that thought for a minute. I'm not trying to jump all around on you. Let me hold that thought for just a minute. First Peter 2:17, Peter wrote to honor all men. Why? Because all men are created in God's image. All men are special to God. God places value on all human life. And do we dare ignore anyone's needs? James wrote, now this is, he wrote as a brother, and some people think this was specifically to brothers in Christ, and it may be, but it's, the thought still applies that if any man see his brother have need and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him? That's a thought we can't get away from. If we have the love of God in us, it will be flowing through us, and we'll be channels, and we'll be stewards of the manifold grace of God. Are there any people around us that as we look at them, we are exempt from esteeming them better than ourselves, more worthy of God's help and grace? I understand that situations can be really, really hard to know how to help. Giving people money doesn't often fix the situation, actually. But sometimes we hide behind that and say, well, that person's beyond help, you know. And, I would challenge you, challenging myself, first of all, and all of us, that that you know the that that we know the real battle and tension of finding how to help people. Because God is faithful at bringing these people into your life. And if you're not dealing with them, if you don't understand this point, like people coming in packages that we would rather ignore, then you're ignoring the call of God on your life, because he's going to bring them into your life. And somehow you're going to have to fight this battle of knowing how to relate to them. Let's just be honest with it and actually help and exemplify Christ. Let's take upon us the mind of Christ. And let's let the community here, wherever, Smithdale, see Christ in action rather than just an explanation of him. And then the last one that we have, he became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And this one, we have to make a little jump here, because maybe it's not a jump, but Christ didn't hide the connection here between his death on the cross and our denying ourselves and taking up our cross and following him as death to our wishes, or death to our desire for an easy life, death to anything that my flesh really wants. And how are we doing in that area? I know I have a lot of room to grow in that area. What expectations do we have out of life? What expectations do you personally have out of life? And then what is your response when those expectations are unmet? I'm not preaching about being a defeatist here. A defeatist is one that has expectations out of life and says, but it'll never happen. That's different than a Christian not having expectations, positive expectations out of life. And I'm not talking about God's goodness. I'm talking about the way the world's going to treat you and how much money you're going to make if you're serving God, and how people even are going to view you and how much damage your reputation's going to suffer at times. And all of you, we have a lot of expectations. We do, that somehow we have a justice system that's built right into us, and we have expectations out of life, and when those go unmet, we're hurt and we think we got the short end of the stick, and we try to go around to set things right too many times. What kind of expectations did Jesus have? And how were they met? I don't know that it's all completely wrong to have some expectations. We do have a built-in justice system, like I mentioned. But we must always come back to the place that Jesus came back to tearfully and say, not my will, but thine be done. Whatever it costs, it simply doesn't matter. Again, I simply ask you to review and see in the area of self-denial, of being self-crucified, those that know you best, your neighbors and your children at home and brothers and sisters and so on, do they see a essay on what Jesus is like, or do they see the mind of Christ and Jesus in shoe leather? Do they see real Christians? And simply to wrap this up, very, very quickly, what is the result of humility? Well, this, of course, could be a sermon in itself, but just two of the basic elements of this is the verse that we read in Matthew said, come unto me, all ye that are laboring and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall what? You will find rest unto your souls. You will find soul rest. And I just want to remind us this morning that there is a very direct connection between how we do in identifying with Jesus in these four areas. In our reputation, being willing to be of no reputation, being willing to be a servant, being willing to minister to everyone's needs, no matter of their status. Jesus made himself in the likeness of men, and being willing to lay down our life for the gospel. There is a direct connection between how seriously we take those points and how well we put them into everyday shoe leather as to the amount of mental, emotional, and spiritual rest that we experience. And it might sound like I'm just saying, well, just lower the bar till you have no expectations. And that's sort of true in some senses. It is sort of true. You'll find soul rest. And then, of course, the part that we sort of ignored even in Philippians 2 there, the part that we sort of ignored, is that there is exaltation that comes to those who humble themselves. There's eternal exaltation. And there might even be some in some ways now. Jesus didn't ignore that thought. I don't know how much we can expect now. Probably if our culture was different, we would view this a little differently. Sometimes we do reap benefits for when we practice humility. Sometimes the results come even somewhat in this life. But that's not what we're laboring for. Jesus taught that in Matthew 20, we should probably go and read those verses, but I'll just paraphrase it for you, I guess. That Jesus taught that whoever wants to be great among you, let him be your servant. No, whoever be great among you, let him be your minister, is how he said it, which means servant, right? Jesus didn't teach that you humble yourself so that you be made great. That's not what he taught. He said humility is greatness. Servanthood is greatness. And there's a big difference. And there's a difference in the way that we practice it. Too many Christians think that, well, I've humbled myself now, just God's going to come along, and I'm just waiting for him to come along and make something great out of me. Well, God might choose to do that in a measure, but he has promised exaltation in eternity, and we labor for that, not knowing exactly what that's going to look like, but we know that when we see him, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. I can't wait until that happens. Not because I can't wait for God to make something great out of us, because as we endeavor to take on the likeness, the mind of Christ, somehow being in his physical presence for eternity is more than what we can imagine. So in conclusion, I simply ask you the question one more time. Does the world see real Christians here? Let's kneel for a word of prayer.